Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of Your Cases on Hold. I can do a little introduction like we normally do. I'm Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor at JBJS and Adult Recon with me.
And I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methodology and House Physician to House Bolton. Our knives are sharp.
They're always sharp for something ready to go. So these opinions are our own. Whether or not you think the knives are sharp or dull, you'll be the judge of that. And we would give a shout out to Clinical Classroom, our new sponsor for this episode of Your Cases on Hold. We're actually seeking orthopedic surgeons with at least 5 years of experience following residency or fellowship to join the Clinical Classroom team to develop questions and learning resources. If you're interested, you'd be board certified and definitely enthusiastic about education because it is the Clinical Classroom. Please email customer support at JBJS to learn more. Yeah. On that note, we're going to go to headlines. So tell us about the headline on healthcare utilization on long-term treatment after combat and non-combat related orthopedic trauma, Dr. Schoenfeld.
Okay. This is research that was supported by the Department of Defense. It's from Brigham and Women's and Harvard Medical School, but that's beside the point. Headed up by an outstanding Harvard medical student, Kaylee Herring, who is herself a graduate of West Point. You heard it here first. Kaylee's going to be doing great things. So headed the orthopedic residency route, and then maybe we can get her into spine. We'll see.
Whoa. Let's not go that far, buddy.
Nonetheless, you heard it here first. Remember that name. So we're talking about healthcare utilization for individuals sustaining combat and non-combat related orthopedic trauma. And as many of our listeners will be aware, one of the biggest challenges in terms of looking at longitudinal care for patients who sustain orthopedic trauma is just a general lack of follow-up and being able to monitor where these individuals are so many years after their traumatic injuries. And there are a lot of factors that play into this: socioeconomic factors, injury-related factors, clinical and medical factors. And they have been able to do some of this on a lower scale in certain types of injuries, but and I think we covered some of that in previous issues of the journal and Your Cases on Hold. However, a robust cohort of patients, talking about thousands of patients with broad clinical variation and a more overarching representative nature, remains to be done. And that's what was done here in this work that used TRICARE, that's the insurance product for the Department of Defense, claims data to look at individuals who were injured in a combat setting and a non-combat setting between 2007 and 2011. And then this is the real advantageous thing because it's kind of a closed network, and individuals who stay within the military service are medically separated with a certain degree of disability or who retire, they continue to receive the TRICARE insurance benefit. So even if they're not on active duty or have to get out because of the injuries, oftentimes you're able to continue to follow the care that they're receiving. So this was a study that matched 2,119 individuals who had combat-related trauma to 2,119 individuals who sustained non-combat-related injuries, and looked at the healthcare requirements, cost, et cetera, over the course of that 7 to 11 year timeframe post-injury. And as expected, combat-related injuries are way more expensive, almost 100,000 more per year, at right about 157,000 a year versus 56,000 for non-combat injured. And severe injuries, more medical comorbidities, and those who sustained amputations were associated with increased risk of healthcare expenditures. And then in these types of studies, junior enlisted rank is used as a proxy for socioeconomic status. And that also was found to be influential. And this may stem from issues related to social support networks, attitudes toward accessing healthcare and behavioral health services, as well as challenges navigating the healthcare system. While this is useful information for the military, Obviously, it also, I think, has a ready corollary to civilian practice, particularly since we're talking about half the individuals considered in this study had the type of, you know, it's not combat-related injury. It's the same type of fractures and severe injuries that you see in a civilian level one academic trauma center. And so I think there are ready corollaries to civilian trauma care. Patients with trauma and those characteristics identified here, particularly in the non-combat group, have readily translatable and generalizable findings, importance of increased access to social services, enhanced rehabilitation pathways, and use of care navigators to minimize the prospect for inferior outcomes and unnecessarily high healthcare costs. This work does have an infographic and it's free for 30 days. So everyone should, the infographic is really awesome actually. So definitely check that out if you only have a little bit of time, and it is worth a read if you have more than just a little bit of time.
I love it. That's actually good information and well put out. And as you said, I hope that she goes into arthroplasty because this is a well done study. Did I say that?
Anything about arthroplasty.
But it is. And, you know, I think one of the nice things too is to realize that these long-term treatments are part of the budgets that we have to realize, right? We look at sometimes 90-day episode of care, 1 year, 2 years, but it's way longer than that in their patient populations.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely.
So talking about long-term, I'm going to look at bipolar hemiarthroplasty compared to unipolar arthroplasty and total hip replacements, looking at analysis of over 36,000 procedures from the Australian Orthopaedic Association National Joint Replacement Registry. And this is by Ferry et al. And so what's interesting in this study, I would say, is that it adds to the hip fracture literature because it breaks down unipolar with bipolar and total hip arthroplasty for the treatment of femoral neck fractures. And I think that's actually a key thing, especially in a big database like that, which is really, really useful. So it does add to the hip fracture literature, which is nice. If you look at just the abstract, though, it can be a little misleading. If you look at the methods, it states it as primary arthroplasty in the methods. So whenever you read these articles, remember to look under the hood because the actual abstract itself may not be enough for the actual information underneath there. Now, the first paragraph, the first section on the background does talk about femoral neck fractures, but it's not looking at primary arthroplasty. It's using primary arthroplasty prostheses per se, but not primary arthroplasty patients. So I think in this study, what's really nice is the exclusion criteria was very appropriate. They were really smart. They took away patients who were greater than 80 or under 50 because you might select different modalities of treatment based on that. They also chose appropriate cementing versus non-cementing. You want to cement a cemented stem and don't cement a non-cemented stem, which is important. And I don't know which of those prostheses were there, but they were removed. And they did remove implants that performed poorly so that it weren't skewing the population because of a poor performing implant as opposed to the actual procedure itself. And finally, low volume hospitals were excluded. So that was really good. It was interesting because they used two different types of analysis that yielded slightly different results, I would say. So the adjusted analysis performed with the use of Cox proportional hazards had significantly higher revision for bipolar and unipolar hemiarthroplasty compared to total hip arthroplasty. Now that stayed true when they used the next type of analysis, and I'm going to ask our methodology editor about this, but the instrumental variable analysis. And so for unipolar, that still remained true that unipolars did not do as well as total hip arthroplasty with regards to their first or primary outcome, which was revision. But for bipolar, they were actually pretty similar. And this instrumental variable analysis is used in the present analysis based on institutional preference. For example, if you have an institution that highly prefers using total hip as a treatment for femoral neck fractures, then it would take that into account. Or if an institution truly highly preferred unipolar for whatever reason, either because of training or because of cost versus bipolar. And those took those into account when it came to instituting this. And again, if an institution was more familiar with the approach, then the analysis demonstrated that bipolar and total hip replacement actually had similar outcomes in the secondary analysis. And it does allow for adjustment of unmeasured confounding variables with the use of time to event data. So that's the idea here of this instrumental variable analysis. What's interesting to me was that they found there was a higher revision for dislocation for total hip arthroplasty and a higher revision for pain or acetabular erosion for bipolar. Not surprising, most studies have shown that. But the interesting thing is that even though dislocation was the most common reason for total hip arthroplasty revision, the most common revision procedure was exchange of the femoral component at 34.5%. I would think that normally when it comes to dislocation, it's probably the acetabular cup is normally what a lot of people find at fault, not necessarily the femoral stem per se. So that was surprising that that's what was changed for a diagnosis of dislocation. It was followed by exchange of the femoral head and insert, with the acetabular component being the least actually added in this cohort study. So it's interesting as what were people thinking when they say, okay, patient had a femoral neck fracture, had a total hip replacement, and we're replacing the femoral stem. But it makes me wonder, more importantly, were things not just on version and problems with dislocation and placement, was because of cement versus not cement? Was it a bone quality thing? Was it loosening? Was it other things that were causing this revision? So using the endpoint of revision is important, but dislocation was high, but the femoral stem change was a little bit interesting. So overall, it's an interesting study. It does demonstrate how adjusted analyses can shape your findings. And I would love your input on this as well.
Yes. I mean, a lot of patients, and to really conduct an instrumental variable analysis, I think you need like those very big patient numbers. So it's ideal for something like this. It's a type of way to address the causal inference issues. There are lots of different approaches, but like you said, the parameters for a well-run IV analysis are all met here. Definitely check it out if you're interested in doing IV analyses, because the methodology can be used as a primer, I think, for this work. So overall, well done. Interesting findings, clinical actionability. Yeah.
There you go. So as the analysis showed, institutions that do it historically are likely to still keep doing it. And if they don't keep doing it, then they're likely to have problems. So kind of a trade-off there. So actionability, maybe not strong, but interesting to see if you're considering a unipolar versus bipolar versus total hip replacement for femoral neck fractures.
Exactly.
Looking for your cases on hold, the one on antibiotic prophylaxis with cefazolin is associated with lower shoulder periprosthetic joint infection rates than non-cefazolin alternatives. By Margaret et al., there's also a commentary on this as well. What are your thoughts on this?
This is Dr. Evil calling, and I didn't spend 4 years in anesthesia residency at the Evil Medical School so that your case could go on time, Dr. Chen. Your case will be on hold until you pay me $1 million or come up with sharks with laser beams.
Sharks with freaking laser beams is what is on hold.
And Mini-Me could be his like CRNA.
That would be paid very well nowadays, especially if they travel.
So this study came out of the Mayo Clinic, and it's a study conducted over the last 20 years. Looking at cefazolin versus non-cefazolin alternatives. They found basically that cefazolin, which is the standard, if you're using that, you have a lower rate of PGI compared with the non-cefazolin alternatives. That's the crux of the matter here. But there are some issues. So the first thing is that obviously in orthopedics, the heart exists to pump ANSEF to the body, right? So like we're going to use cefazolin as a prophylactic antibiotic at any time, like given our druthers. So when you can't use it, well, why can't you use it? There's an issue. And I'm really wondering here whether the antibiotic agent is really a proxy for risk. And you can see that very readily in the table 5, where MRSA colonization, which would be an indication not to use cefazolin, is also its own independent risk factor, even when you're accounting for the antibiotics administered, with a pretty high hazard ratio. The factors that they're considering, I'm not sure that they have a full, robust assessment that they can control for, you know, other confounders in this area. So it isn't necessarily just if given the chance. First off, you'd use ANSEF anyway, and if you can't and you have to go to one of these others, well, those patients, it's not the impact of the medication. It may just be the impact of the reason why you have to go to these other medications. They're just at a higher baseline risk for the infection. The other point is that there are only 101 infection cases over 20 years. So it's a relatively small number of cases that you're using to sort of build this. Is this representative? Secular trends is always a major issue in studies like this, because the science of orthopedic surgery was evolving over those 20 years. The science of anesthesia was evolving over those 20 years. And it's like in The Exorcist, where they're in the house and they keep flashing up like the pictures of the demon. It's secular trends are just in the milieu. It's just contaminating the study environment. It's an excellent day for an exorcism.
Excellent.
You can't get rid of the secular trends, though. There's no way to exorcise them. And so this also could be creating some substantive confounders and impacting the clinically actionable information from this and the generalizability of the study findings. Interesting work. It's done from the Mayo Clinic, like we discussed. You know, you're not going to get 20 years of 7,713 shoulder arthroplasties in many other places to be able to really, you know, make these kinds of large-scale determinations, but you have to take it with the issues that are baked in as well.
Proverbial grain of salt. That's what you have there, right? What's interesting, there's a very similar study done by the Mayo Group, also by Wiles and all in 2019, that got a John Charnley Award, looking at the exact same question, saying, if you don't use cefazolin or cefazolin, you know, potato, potato, tomato, tomato, is there a difference? And this is actually published in BJJ in 2019. And it showed that in a population of over 29,000 patients, so a lot more arthroplasties there, and then more infections, they had a higher infection risk if they were not getting cefazolin. Now, the catch, as you're saying, is why were they not receiving it? One of the things they asked, which I think is a fair one, which is interesting, is saying, should we test patients prior to surgery for allergy or not? And if that's the case, then potentially you can get rid of a tag for cefazolin or allergy, and you can actually administer it if it is truly better or not, which obviously this is not giving us the definitive answer. What was interesting is I think it would be nice if they actually separated elective from trauma cases, because we saw trauma cases were actually a risk for infection. So it'd be nice to actually separate it out, but the problem is then their infection rate would go even lower, which would be less to drive from. So that's a hard part. They also, you know, talked about saying they would give other alternative medications based on a medical history suggestive of the potential need for additional microbial coverage. That's pretty general. Not quite sure what that means. That can mean healthcare workers or a history of MRSA or things like that, where you would want to maybe give vancomycin, but not quite sure why. They did 2-year follow-up, which I thought was good, but you don't need it necessarily for infection. I think 1-year follow-up is appropriate. One of the things I found interesting is they found that non-antibiotic impregnated cement increase the risk of infection. And what I want to caution is that don't do a take-home message of putting antibiotic cement in everyone to reduce the risk of infection, because it's just a finding that comes with this, but just be careful with that. But that is one of the findings that they did have in the study.
You just don't get it, do you, Scott? Your case is on hold.
On hold, sharks with laser beams coming your way. All right, ready for a toss-up? Outcomes of survivorship at a medium of 8.9 years, not 8 years, not 9 years, but 8.9 years following hip arthroscopy in adolescents with femoral acetabulate impingement, a matched comparative study with adults. This is by Fukase et al. And it is free for 30 days, so no excuse not to read it. Tell me what you think.
Very precise measurements from the Stedman Philippon Research Institute in Vail, Colorado. They matched 157 of their eligible adolescent patients, so 80% of the overall cohort, to adults, looking at hip arthroscopy outcomes in the growing adolescents, a physeal-sparing approach for femoral acetabular impingement. They found essentially that the clinical outcomes were superior compared to those in the matched adult group. Overall, the numbers are somewhat small. I mean, they do the PROs and looking at, you know, the various Harris hip scores and things of that nature. Revision procedures were very low, 9% in the adolescent group and 11% in the adult group. So all that is good, but it's restricted numbers overall. And I just wonder if the comparison to the adults is legitimate. This, you know, it kind of falls back on my Donnie Brasco paradigm, which is like, it's a beautiful thing, but it's not my thing. If you're telling an adolescent, well, we're going to do the surgery for you, and you're going to do much better than if you were an adult, Or if it's an adult and you're like, well, if you were only younger and not yet fully grown, you'd do awesome. Like neither of those conversations help the person that you're actually talking to. So it's a beautiful thing, but it's not my thing. You know, undercover, Donnie Brasco, I left my East Coast girl, the Bentley, the Pearl, the West Coast shorty, pushed the Chrome 740. At the end of the day, the concluding statement is FAI and rather hip arthroscopy for FAI in growing adolescents with a physio sparing approach is safe and effective. I want to see the research study that says this is unsafe and not effective. You don't ever see
unpublished medicine.
Unsafe. This is unsafe, marked unsafe. And not effective. So it's safe and effective. It yields superior clinical outcomes than to adults. I think, obviously, if you want to use this approach in adolescents with FAI, this definitely supports that kind of work. Beyond that, I don't know what more there is that can really be taken from this. I can't get over the comparison to adults. I think is a challenging paradigm from a method standpoint anyway.
That's the first thing on my list of things. It's really hard to do. It's not an ideal population. One, it's a little bit skewed. If your patient, even though the ages were 20 to 40 for adults, so they didn't go above 40, which is good, you're less likely to convert to a total hip replacement if you're a younger population. If you're in the 20 to 40 range, you might do so. You might just tell an adolescent, just hold out. So an endpoint of conversion may not be as valid in that database, at that data point, because you're like, just wait it out. So that's one thing. They did matching on BMI and year of surgery, which, you know, they can't obviously match on age because the purposes are two different age cohorts. But it would be actually interesting to see if they did indication for surgery or pathology, you know, CAM versus pincher lesion or labral tear and things like that. That would be kind of good to see. And what was interesting, I was surprised to see that the surgical procedure between groups were actually similar. I would think that more adults would be debrided as opposed to repaired for the labrum. But again, this is the Philippon Institute. They do a lot of these. So potentially they skew towards more repair, which would be fine for the adolescents as well as the young adult population. And I'm going to keep young adult for 20 to 40 and above. So we'll keep the age in that time frame. But as it says, this is a good option for adult adolescent patients. There's long follow-up and we're going to publish stuff that says this is good for you, because if it's not good for you, we may not want to talk about it as much, although we will talk about it in a little bit.
If it was unsafe, you wouldn't want to talk about it too much.
I don't even want to do it anymore, actually. So talking about unsafe, we can actually switch to our next topic, which is immediate to long-term outcomes and causes of aseptic failure of an at-risk femoral stem by Gazendem and et al. So I'll take the first stab at this one because this is in my wheelhouse of arthroplasty. So talking about implants or maybe procedures that may not do as well. So total hip replacements we know do really, really well. In general, most stems have done really well over time. This is specifically looking at the Accolade TMZF stem. And it was a stem that was available mostly in the 2000s area. And basically it showed that over time, there was a lot of reports of these stems coming in with melted trunnions. So if you looked at them, they would come in and they would like their beak would have disappeared essentially. And it's basically severe trunnionosis to the point that they dislocated, but not because the ball came out of the socket, because the trunnion came out of the ball. So it was really, really bad. There's a bunch of reporting.
Did they melted?
It looked like it was melted. It would basically look like they call it beaked appearance, actually. Like the femoral neck would just go this tiny little, like a pecker of a beak. And they went
exposed to liquid hot magma.
And if we put a laser beam on it, it would be magical. So they had these things that would come in and like the hip would be black. I mean, it would just be a black mess, unfortunately, inside there. So it was a concern that people had with the stem. So these researchers in Canada basically said, okay, let's look at all of ours nationwide and see how this stem did. And Canada is the right database for, or a database as for it, because it's one national system. You follow patients for a long period of time, and that's beneficial. So it's a single payer system. The pause I put on this study is that it's only looking at one implant, right? And the other thing I would also put in this too is that's the point of our registries. Our registries are to be able to look at the long-term outcomes, mid to long-term outcomes of these implants. And I would argue that all the different registries have this data, right? The Australian, the New Zealand, the English registry, all of them have this data on these implants.
The Wakanda registry.
The Wakanda registry is probably
our Wakanda Telegram registry.
But because their metals are way more precious than ours, and there is no beaking when it comes to that, it withstands everything.
Adamantium total joint implants are really where it's at.
there's no nickel in it, so we're fine. I want to start putting those. I want one of those if I need the joint replacement, especially if it makes me regenerate really easily. Mm-hmm. So a little Wolverine action goes a long way. So that's one of those big things here too, is that, you know, there's a lot of follow-up. What's interesting is they use 76.2% metal heads, but still had a low rate of trunnionosis. And that's a big thing when it comes to trunnionosis. People say it's metal heads instead of ceramic heads. That's why most of us have switched to ceramic heads worldwide. So maybe the metal heads alone is not the reason for it. So basically they say, be careful of small femoral stem size. If you have a higher head offset and use a skirted head, then you're likely to have more problems. But in general, their survivorship was quite good. Just surprising to see its whole study for just one stem.
Yes. And it's a high volume center, so not necessarily translatable or generalizable to every place. Trunnionosis as the cause for revision surgery was rare is like one of their main conclusions. Obviously, it's happened enough, rare or not, that stems are melting in some places.
I'm melting.
Yeah, rare or not, when it does happen, it's bad. And maybe sometimes if there's even any risk of it happening, you want to look for another option.
Yeah. So there you go. Let's go for the big finish.
All right. Going to finish up fast.
Long-term survival of Hintera total ankle replacement in 683 patients, not 680, not 690, a concise 20-year follow-up of a previous report.
So this is a follow-on, and we're really in a renaissance of total ankle research, I feel. Like in the last couple of episodes, issues of the journal, there's been a lot on total ankle replacement and outcomes. This is, you know, a well-done synopsis, follow-on of a previous report looking at long-term survival of the Hintegra total ankle replacement. It's really a clinical epidemiology retrospective. It has level 4 evidence. I really wish there was like another category for level of evidence that was outside where it's just these clinical epidemiology retrospectives. I mean, it is, yes, level 4 technically, but at the same time, it's just their experience. It's not a study. It's just, it's like an expose. Like they're telling you about their experience over 20 years and good survival, good outcomes, the potential for selection indication, expertise bias. Really pro tip, best practice for others to emulate. When they report their incidence rates, the survival rate and things like that, they also give you the 95% confidence interval, which is really good. And that at least lets you see that like it could be in this range. But again, it's the 683 patients. It's from their center. It's with their techniques and their experience, not necessarily translatable. But definitely worth taking a look at. And it's a follow-on to a previous article that was published in 2013 in the journal, which you might want to familiarize yourself with as well.
Sounds like you're going to come up with the new levels of evidence infographic. I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah, that's an idea.
Born here. Mine is looking at novel fluoroscopic view for improved assessment for the safety of the posterior superior screw and femoral neck fracture fixation by Terhune et al. I like the study in that they look at sawbones and cadavers. And I think as surgeons, we think we're better than we sometimes are. So they basically said, all right, here's sawbones, here are cadavers, put the screw in and we're going to go check them out. See if they're in bone or if they go in the bone, out the bone and in the bone. And if it goes in, out, in, one problem is it may not have good fracture fixation. It can also lead to disruption of the blood supply. If it leads to disruption of the blood supply, they get AVN and then they come to see me next to get a total hip replacement. Which is good for me, not good for the patient. And we want what's good for the patient. So I do like that. And that they actually looked at this and they interestingly found that attendings and residents did similarly when it came to putting these screws in. And it just gave us a new way to look at x-rays. So we all put x-rays the same way every time. So they looked at novel fluoroscopic viewpoints. So take these viewpoints for residents and fellows who are listening to this, for attendings who are doing this, make sure you look at this. Take these parameters and institute these into practice. Is it hard to get your radiologist to do so or your technologist to do so in the OR? Probably. Learn how to do it yourself. If you need to run the C-arm, run the C-arm. Gives you a better view so you don't go in, out, in, and you're in better bones. So take this viewpoint. It's a very practical pearl.
All right. I'm talking about spontaneous facet joint osteoarthritis in the NFAT1 mutant mouse. This is by Wang and colleagues. It's from the University of Kansas. The facet joint osteoarthritis is like the ignored Jan to the discogenic back pain, Marcia. Like gets all the attention, the discogenic back pain, but facet joint mediated pain is far more common. And we do have challenges modeling this in the basic science space. So what the authors have done is they have mutant nuclear factor of activated T cells 1 transcription factor mice, that's abbreviated NFAT1. And this has now created a novel animal model of spontaneous facet joint osteoarthritis. Here's the kicker: age dependent and slowly progressive with time. So really mimics kind of the experience in humans, as opposed to like sudden onset or something that's very destructive that you can work with in the lab, but maybe not exactly have a one-to-one corollary with human facet joint osteoarthritis. So their hope is that this will provide some new insights into the pathogenesis and therapeutic strategies for facet joint osteoarthritis, which is an under-recognized, not unrecognized, but under-recognized problem. And it's good work, definitely worth checking out, and a basic science study that has important implications going forward.
Love it. And I'm finishing it up with association of a wider medial gap, medial laxity inflection with self-reported knee instability after medial pivot total knee arthroplasty by Uema et al. Interestingly enough, this is looking at a true medial pivot knee. So there's medial pivot knees that are inserts they can put in there versus medial pivot knees that actually come with the femoral component. And it really pivots around the medial aspect to mimic the native knee when it comes to the medial meniscus, which moves less than the lateral meniscus. What's interesting is they looked at patients who had this, and they actually looked at their gaps, and they did this through a flexion. They used axial knee radiography to assess the flexion joint gap balance. And they show that the studies have looked at this before and has been very useful to assess joint laxity in this manner. I think fluoro is another really good way to do so. And it's live as well too. So you can see them through activities such as going up and down stairs where you do engage flexion. So I think it'd be nice to actually have that kind of live radiographic view as just sort of an axial knee view to see it. But studies have supported this viewpoint to do so. It's also one of those things where they're reporting a very high rate of instability, which is surprising for this knee. The whole point of this knee was to provide actually more stability, and they're upwards of 20% of instability, which is pretty high. They did look at range of motion. They looked at the PROMs, like knee society score and forgotten joint score, and patient reported subjective knee instability. And we know that's a very subjective measurement. And basically that they found that if you had this knee laxity on the medial side after a medial pivot knee, it will affect the patient's instability scores. And it also correlates with PROMs. So the hard part is the applicability of this. You know, do you not use this implant because of this? Do you make them really tight because of that? Do you want to assess their medial side because of that and make sure their flexion gap is tight? Doesn't take extension gap into here and talk about hyperextension, things like that. So it's one of those areas where it's reporting on a medial pivot knee, and there's not as many studies on medial pivot knees, but you really want to be careful, I guess, when doing this to be careful of medial laxity. And I think in any total knee in general, you want to not leave them with any flexion instability.
That'll do it. Everyone, we're going to be at the Association for Bone and Joint Surgeons meeting in June. So if you're there and you're liking what you hear on Your Case on Hold, definitely let us know in person. We'll be there, but your case will still be on hold.
See you then.